From Indianapolis and 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is your WFYI Weekly News Roundup. The news week started over the weekend as hundreds of thousands of women and men took part in women's marches at dozens of cities across the country and the world. An estimated 7,000 marchers gathered at the West Side Plaza of the Indiana State House. Rabbi Sandy Sasso noted the diversity in the crowd.
We have come here as Americans, especially as American women. In our vast diversity, we are the face of America.
The crowd was there in part to protest the words and actions of President Donald Trump, who won Indiana easily in November. Indianapolis Democratic State Representative Carrie Hamilton told the crowd to stay united and not let rhetoric divide them.
A strong democracy requires everyone's participation. People of all political stripes, we must respectfully engage with each other.
The Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department is doing its part to keep the city's immigrant communities connected. WFYI's Drew Dodelin reports.
In a recent visit to a grocery store on the south side of Indianapolis, IMPD officer Randy Diaz struck up a friendly conversation with the owner. He told Diaz he'd been stolen from over and over. So Diaz asked,
"My question to him is, did you call the police?" And he said, "No."
It turns out he didn't call police because he didn't know they could help him. Diaz's partner Candy Perry was there too.
He asked this question, "Should I stop them and frisk them?" You know, so it's basic things like that that he didn't know.
The store owner is Chin. He's one of over 10,000 members of the Burmese ethnic group that migrated to Indy's south side starting about 15 years ago. His story represents a growing problem that IMPD is trying to address with its immigrant outreach unit. Diaz and Perry are the only officers in the unit, so they have a lot of ground to cover. To reach more people, they often put on events.
"So it's okay if I pick you, then you're smiling, so I'll pick you. Come on up here."
About a dozen Chin immigrants have come to a community center in their neighborhood for a two-hour crash course on police in Indiana. It's tailor-made not only for people who speak very little English, but for immigrants and refugees who might not know anything about the role of American police.
"Okay. Then, we're going to talk a little bit about keeping safe when we come to and from our homes or to and from our cars in our community."
One lesson led the audience through a simulated traffic stop using two chairs and a table as a makeshift car. Diaz describes in meticulous detail the ritual officers follow and what to do if you get pulled over.
"The number one thing, always stay in your car."
The lesson is especially important for Chin immigrants. During a traffic stop in Burma, people get out of their cars to greet the officer, a move that could be dangerous in America. Na Pa is a Chin native who moved to Indiana in 2002. She says that in Burma, people feared the police, and she saw that fear in some of the refugee children she helped drive to their new Indiana homes.
"I remember some kids would see police car pass by, and they'd be like, 'Oh, there is police,' so they would just go down to the floor."
Pa says events that offer a personal relationship with police have had a profound effect on immigrants from Burma. Pa has two children of her own, and she says she's confident the second generation of Burmese in Indiana will be able to shake off the distrust of police that their parents brought with them.
"Especially for the Burmese, it's always in our mind that you see the police in a negative way. So that needs to be changed completely, and you have to build up the trust."
"The city is rapidly evolving into a multicultural city."
That's IMPD Assistant Chief James Waters, who oversees the Immigrant Outreach Unit. Waters sees it as part of a bigger cultural shift in the department towards community policing. His goal is to expand the unit to six officers, one for each district. Waters says Candy Perry helped him test his immigrant outreach strategy on the east side in a Latino community rife with unreported crime.
"As we began to talk to them, they began to talk to us. And so statistically, crime went up, but we were able to then identify where to put our resources to reduce that crime."
Perry says she hopes more contact with the police, real human contact, will build trust between immigrants and the police. She remembers a recent meeting with a group of non-English speakers.
"We went to each of them, it's like, hello.
Yeah.
And they're like, hello. You know, and it becomes a positive thing to say, okay, we're human. We're people. And we want to get to know you and we want you to know us.
And Perry says it's not just about the police. She says when community institutions like IMPD promote a culture that welcomes immigrants into Indiana, the native population will ultimately follow. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Drew Doblin.
With the WFYI Weekly News Roundup, I'm Jill Dittmeyer. The RCA manufacturing plant, once a beacon of prosperity that employed hundreds of workers on the Indianapolis Near East Side, closed its doors in 1995. This week, it came down, making way for redevelopment to begin in that area. John Franklin Hay is executive director of the Near East Area Renewal. He says local residents are elated about the news.
They would actually patrol this property. They found some really terrible things that have happened here. And so this removes that part of blight. We now give attention to the contamination of this property and then give attention to redevelopment.
The 50-acre site around the plant is called Sherman Park, and it is one of a few areas that the city is considering to be home of a new justice center. Also this week, Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett announced that the city will be getting $55 million in tax credits from the U.S. Department of Treasury to help transform other neighborhoods.
It means jobs. It means new housing. It means new community opportunities. It means new beginnings, new investments, new starts.
In 2010, the city received similar money, which was used to help develop the Ivy Tech Culinary School and Conference Center. You're listening to 90.1 WFYI's Weekly News Roundup. News this week that the number of meth lab busts in Indiana are going down. But Indiana State Police Sergeant Mike Tolles says there's still a high demand for the illegal stimulant.
I hope people don't forget about methamphetamine. We have a lot of meth addicts, and we have a lot of people that have some serious issues that are self-medicating, whether it be through meth or heroin.
Toll says the decline in meth labs actually began last year before the new law requiring pharmacists to police sales of pseudoephedrin, which is the main meth precursor, actually took effect on July the 1st. This week, we learned how genetic tests are helping doctors find better treatments for people with depression. WFYI's Lee DeNoon has that story.
Jan Northam is a retired nurse. While working in the ER not long after Prozac came on the market in the late 1980s, she discovered the medication tremendously helped her depression.
I had a friend that I worked with who was taking it, and I said, dang. I mean, we were at the emergency room, and I said, I want to feel like you. I said, you are handling things so well, you know, because sometimes you're overwhelmed and you just want to walk out for a while, you know, and you can't.
Northam stayed on Prozac for years, paying out of pocket for the name brand because she thinks generics don't work as well. When she retired, she could no longer afford the $450 a month, so she tried a generic but wasn't happy with the results. When her physician retired, her new doctor put her on Lexapro. It helped only a little, she says, at first.
I was short-tempered with my grandkids, my kids, too. I mean, it just came out of the blue. That's not good. And that was not me.
As her depression worsened, Northam found herself thinking about suicide, something she says she would never seriously consider because of her family. Then, when Northam had to change doctors again, she found a new ally in her fight against depression.
I'm Beth Buchanan. I'm a family practice physician. I've been in practice over 30 years.
Buchanan practices in Shelbyville and recently learned about pharmacogenomics, or DNA testing, to help rule in or out the best antidepressants for an individual.
It's totally about metabolism, and I want to be clear that it doesn't predict what medicine will work well for you. It doesn't predict efficacy, but it might explain lack of efficacy.
Northam took the test, and the results came back showing Lexapro isn't a good genetic match. She doesn't metabolize it well. So she and Buchanan agreed to try one from the list her body would metabolize. They once again tried a generic version of Prozac. This time, it's working. And she's grateful for the test.
If nothing else, I think it takes away that trial and error because you don't have time for that. Once you start that downhill slide, you don't have time, you know, because it's going to get worse.
Northam's metabolism test helped rule out drugs that wouldn't work. But what if doctors could accurately pinpoint those that would?
My name is John Nurnberger, and I'm a professor of psychiatry here at Indiana University School of Medicine. I've been working in the area of psychiatric genetics for about 40 years.
Nurnberger says clinical trials with Assurex, the company that created the genetic test Northam used, are underway now at IU. And part of the study is to determine from a genetic standpoint which drugs will best treat an individual patient's depression.
They've also added in what we call some pharmacodynamic measures. And the pharmacodynamic measures are not so much how the body metabolizes the drug, but how the body responds to the drug. That is what the receptors do and how the drug interacts with receptors in the brain.
Andy says by Assurex and other companies refining the genetic tests, there's hope even more of the trial and error in prescribing antidepressants will go away, hastening relief for people like Jan Northam. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Lee Dinoon.
The Indiana DNR has approved three new nature preserve sites in the state. Two parcels are in the Harrison Crawford State Forest near Louisville, and the other is the Pisgah Marsh in northeastern Indiana. The DNR says each will protect both plant and animal life, including several state endangered species like the Indiana bat. Also this week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service increased the reward to $10,000 for any information leading to the fatal shooting of an endangered whooping crane in Indiana that took place earlier this month. Lilly Endowment is investing more than $9 million to help school districts improve their counseling programs. The grants can be used to hire consultants, travel to other school districts in the state or the country, or to view other counseling models, and also to conduct research about a current program.
What do you wonder about Indianapolis?
Why did Pogues Run get buried underground?
Why are there so many potholes?
Who's in charge of synchronizing all the stoplights in town?
With Curious Indy, you can ask questions and help WFYI News decide what we should be reporting on next, and sometimes even be part of finding the answer. So, Curious Indy? Go to WFYI.org/Curious Indy to find out more.
With the WFYI Weekly News Roundup, I'm Jill Dittmeyer. The host of the award-winning PBS series This Old House and Ask This Old House brought his knowledge to the Indianapolis Home Show this week at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. WFYI's Taylor Bennett had an opportunity to chat with Kevin O'Connor.
Always a great place to see ideas, new ideas, and talk to the experts. What are some of the things that you're most excited about in home design right now? Any trends out there going on that you like?
I like the continuation of the informal home, the way our houses are continuing to go towards open floor plans, getting family and guests into what used to be very sort of closed off spaces like the kitchens and making kitchens part of family rooms. So I'm excited about that. I think there's also a trend for cleaner lines. So even in traditional homes, of which we have a ton of back here in New England, old Victorians and such, those homes, what I'm seeing is that we're keeping some of the traditional features on the outside, but we're having sort of more modern, cleaner features on the inside, less trim, less moldings, more open spaces. It's a style that I particularly like because I like that informality of, you know, having my family and friends gathering around the kitchen and the family room. So those excite me. And technology, I think, is just out there, and it's ready for prime time. There are lots of different technologies that are being brought into the house for energy efficiency, but also for control over lighting, controlling over moods, controlling over heating and cooling, controlling over appliances. I think that's all very exciting.
It does seem like technology is always out there, and it's always changing. So being able to keep up with those trends, too, always seems challenging.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of early adapters to technology, thank goodness, and they're the ones who take the brunt of the systems that maybe have bugs or eventually go away. I think we're still on the very front edge and early stage of those things. So, you know, there's a lot of people rushing in to bring technology into the house, and I think there's going to be a lot of bumps along the way. But we are a good 5 years into it in terms of adoption, and that means that for some, you know, very simple things, you can get some very reliable technology. I mean, it just goes without saying that you can now have smartphone control over your thermostat, which gives you remote control over heating and cooling in more precise ways to make the house comfortable. I think those are here and ready for prime time. Some of the things that maybe are on the earlier stage but show a lot of promise, you know, are coming our way, and that's exciting too, whether you have ways to monitor the house, ways for voice command of systems in the house, you know, this idea that you could walk in and simply just say, turn on the lights or turn on the heating and cooling system. So that stuff excites me. There's going to be some bumps along the way, but it's exciting at the same time.
The projects on the show are always fun to watch, you know, from start to finish, and you guys always make it look so easy. I've had some remodeling nightmares when I had my house. So do you have any practical advice for homeowners who are tackling a project, whether it be small or major?
Patience and fortitude. It is going to take longer than you plan, and it is going to cost more than you expect. It's a very complicated process. There are lots of things going on in any given house. You know, the way it is built, but it has to do, it has to have an engineering component to stay up. It has to have a comfort component to keep you warm and dry. It has a very technical component in terms of a burning fossil fuel device in the basement, pushing hot air or water around the house at the right temperature and pressures and all that. You know, I could go on and on, but the house is a complicated place. And when you start digging into it, you know, in many ways, it's like a surgeon digging into the body. There's a lot of different interconnected systems. And so be ready for the unexpected.
This week, Visit Indiana reported another record year of tourism for the city of Indianapolis. Their most recent information is from 2015. The group says 28.2 million visitors spent time and money in the city that year. The organization also predicts continued success from conventions, as it was able to secure a number of important contracts in 2016, including extending Gen Con through 2021. And this week, Carson's said it will extend its Circle Center lease for 5 years. The department store lease had been scheduled to expire next year. Tonight, the best-selling show of the 2016 Indie Fringe Festival makes its world premiere as a full-length musical. Calder the Musical celebrates the life of American artist Alexander Sandy Calder. He's best known for his creative, whimsical mobiles. I spent some time at rehearsal talking with the creators and the cast about the show. Fringe Basile Theater is busy tonight as the cast of Calder the Musical practices steps and rehearses lines created for them by Indianapolis arts veterans writer-director Tom Alvarez and composer Dustin Klein. Klein fell in love with a book about Calder and showed it to Alvarez.
We thought that we could turn that story into a musical, and he sat down at the piano and started playing melodies, and I thought, well, you know, I'm a writer. I've never written lyrics, but I have a theater background. I'm a critic. I've been seeing theater for years, so I bet you I could do it. And the musical was born. And Alexander Calder, as it turns out now, after we've developed this, what better time to do a musical about a man whose life was all about creating this whimsical world of innocence. And, you know, escapism is coming back, especially with what's going on in the world. So we think we have a show for its time.
He was in Paris in the 20s and 30s with all these, you know, celebrities, and they made a wire circus, and I immediately thought of this wire circus, how we could like bring it to life on stage with dance and music.
Their original version was a smash hit at the Indie Fringe Festival, so they added more songs and an important dance sequence to this version.
As we do this, the songs tend to come out faster and faster, like as we write together, which is great. Now Tom gives me the lyrics and I put it to music. And in the Fringe version, we couldn't feature the mobile part because there were so many parts of his life, and that was an important part. But there's a dance. It's a ballet where the dancers are the mobile moving.
Say those in the know. They had to add cast members, too, as many of the fringe actors went on to other shows. Logan Moore plays Sandy Calder.
He just follows his dream. You know, he's a guy that, you know, in the beginning of the show, he's a kid who got bullied all the time, and he had this special gift. You know, he created art, you know, and just piddled around with wire, you know, and both of his parents were artists. So, you know, like any kid who looks up to his parents, you know, he kind of fell into that and got bullied for it. So, you know, and then his dad just, he wanted him to be more successful and an engineer and stuff. And so he kind of got pigeonholed into something that I don't think he really felt like he wanted to do.
Moore says he knew nothing about Calder, but discovered a personal connection.
He doesn't want to do engineering anymore, and he wants to do art and just live out his dreams no matter what. So that's what he does. He drops everything behind, and he goes to Paris and just starts living his life as an artist. So, I mean, it kind of speaks to, like, what I'm doing right now, you know, just here in Indianapolis being a theater guy, you know, just that's my dream, my passion.
The 14-member cast includes four teens who play the roles of Calder and his wife as children. 11-year-old Jordan Picar is delighted to be part of this cast.
I am one of the Peggy Calders.
What do you have to do as that role?
We sing a song with young Sandy Calder, and we have a little monologue talking to the mother about Sandy getting beat up at school, and then we are in a ton of dances, so.
He was an artist who, you know, he actually was quite political, but he expressed his politics through his work, which he felt he wanted to create this world that all it was all about. He didn't have any kind of pretensions. He hated the idea of talking too much about it. So he didn't even call it art. He called them objects. And we want to be uplifting. It is family friendly, so anybody could see it. Would take away that sense of innocence that he brought and joy.
Calder the Musical will be live on stage at the Indie Fringe Basile Theater at the corner of Mass Ave and St. Clair Street in downtown Indianapolis starting tonight and will run through February the 12th. You've been listening to the WFYI Weekly News Roundup. You can get the latest local news anytime online at our website, WFYI.org. I'll be back with more local news later this afternoon during All Things Considered, but stay tuned now for The Lawmakers, a weekly look at the Indiana General Assembly. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.